Good evening, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com.
Today's show is sponsored by Austria's Finest Naturally Authentic Pumpkin Seeds and Pumpkin Seed Oil from the Steiermark, available at OrganicUniverse.com. Listeners of The Organic View can receive $1 off their purchase by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW.
For other promotional offers, please visit TheOrganicView.com's website.
As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, which is the only radio show focused on the impact of neonicotinoids, my special guest co-host, Colorado beekeeper Tom Theobald, and I are going to discuss this week's news and also have a few folks that are going to be calling in. So I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, June, from chilly Colorado. It was 10 below this morning, and I had to jump start the chickens.
How about that? Wow, where do you go from there? Well, this week there were two major conference calls that were created to discuss the efforts to help pollinators. One was hosted by Cornell University and the other by EPA. So before we take the first call, I'd like to just talk a little bit about this discussion with Cornell University. The purpose of the discussion was to discuss IPM and pollinators. So, Tom, you participated in this call. What are your thoughts?
Well, I participated to the extent that I was listening to what they were saying. I didn't make any comments or ask any questions. I think it's worthwhile to raise this question, but I have to say the net effect of the webinar really was kind of, there wasn't much effect. There was a lot of talk about various aspects of integrated pest management. The lead speaker was Jeff Pettis, former research leader for the USDA, and I only got the second half of Jeff's presentation, but I have to say I was a little disappointed. He seemed to be a little too apologetic and inclined to place the responsibility for these losses, many of them anyway, on the backs of the beekeepers, and he shied away from any concrete statements about what is really the elephant in the room, which is the neonicotinoid pesticides. So, Jennifer Sass of the Natural Resources Defense Council spoke, and she did a good job of bringing out many of the important elements. Tom Moriarty was there representing the EPA, and I was a little uneasy with some of the things that he had to say. He seemed to want to work the systemic pesticides, the neonicotinoids, into the paradigm of integrated pest management, and it seemed totally inappropriate to me. And as I was listening to what he was saying, I thought to myself, when did the EPA become responsible for the welfare of agriculture? That's not their responsibility. Their responsibility is the protection of the environment and the American people against unreasonable risk. If there's anyone who's out there to protect agriculture, it would be the USDA. So I think the EPA is just being grossly mismanaged.
Well, I just want to make one point. Cornell traditionally does promote in their IPM practices that the last solution is to use chemicals, and that's how they've been for a very long time. I'm a master gardener, and when we were taught some of the practices, it's not something that they promote. So I think that they were trying to get a discussion out there to get people together, but I do agree with some of your points, Tom.
Well, I think the discussion was good, but my concern is I see a subtle but definite effort to distort the concept of integrated pest management and turn it into integrated pesticide management. And I think we need to be alert to that possibility because it just doesn't belong. The neonicotinoids have no place in integrated pest management.
Thanks,
they have
Tom.
No place, period.
Thank you, Tom. Now, the second conference discussion, rather, was EPA stakeholders listening session. And joining us is Tiffany Fink-Haines from Friends of the Earth, who's on the line with us. Tiffany, are you there?
Hi, June. I'm here.
Hey, Tiffany. Welcome to the show. Tiffany, I know that you not only participated in the discussion at EPA, but you were physically there. So could you share with us what your experience was and what you thought of the event?
Sure, absolutely. So I think what's interesting about this listening session is that it was exactly what the title is. It was a complete listening session by all of EPA, although they'd said that they were open to comments and questions, although there were a number of questions posed by different stakeholders that attended the conference. EPA didn't actually have any intention of answering those questions. They just took notes of what was stated and then reemphasized that regardless of people that showed up to these listening sessions, they wanted them to submit comments to a docket which is open through November 24th. So in order for those comments to fully be heard. So it was clear that the EPA was there listening, but how much of what was said and presented during those listening sessions, we have to wait and see what they really take into account. And most likely, they're really just going to be reading through the comments they receive on the docket. And given they're having these two listening sessions this week and then on the 17th, there was very limited time to prepare. They just announced these listening sessions last week, and so there was very little time for stakeholders, beekeepers, farmers to be ready to call in or, you know, take time out of their busy schedules to make sure that they could either physically be present or join into the webinar. However, they did allow members of industry to sign up ahead of time, which they hadn't advertised throughout their announcements of these listening sessions. So the first 20 to 30 minutes of the listening session was dominated by Bayer Crop Science and Bayer CropLife America and other industry groups who really took up a good section of the floor. So for the next listening session, it's important that people email EPA ahead of time to try to make sure that they get on the queue in order to speak and that they have some time given to them.
Tiffany, could you just share with our listeners the concerns that you had expressed to EPA?
Absolutely. So I shared five different points that I really wanted to urge EPA to take in order to better protect bees and other pollinators. The first was to suspend the registrations of neonicotinoids for agricultural uses, including seed treatments, as well as cosmetic and other unnecessary uses, pending the results of pesticide reevaluation. I also asked the EPA prioritize the systemic insecticides for registration review starting now, this year in 2014, and ensure that there's inclusion of independent peer-reviewed research on the acute and chronic effects of systemic insecticides on pollinators. I also asked that they expedite the development and implementation of valid test guidelines for sublethal effects of pesticides on pollinators and require data from those studies for all currently registered and any new pesticides, and that they require a strong and effective bee hazard statement on the label of all products containing systemic insecticides toxic to pollinators, including, but of course not limited to, soil-applied pesticides, bags of coated seeds, and boiler-use products. And I also applauded the administration, specifically the Center on Environmental Quality, for recently releasing pollinator guidelines, but those are just guidelines, and I ask that they become requirements on all federal agencies and federal lands, because they look to limit pesticide use, specifically asks that federal agencies and federal lands do not use systemic insecticides and do not plant pollinator-friendly plants that have been pre-treated with systemic insecticides.
Tiffany, I tried to access the webinar by way of the internet and had a complete failure. I couldn't get any video. I couldn't get any audio. I did get the written comments that were being exchanged between other participants, and it seemed that for the first hour there was almost total discussion about the technical problems. Did that interfere with the conduct of this listening session from your viewpoint?
I think it was really tricky for people on the phone or on the webinar like you, Tom, and then also for people in the room. So there was a lot of static noise in the room from people that were trying to call in, which made it really hard for EPA officials that were there trying to listen to hear what was being said, and for people in the room to even understand what the comments were that were trying to be delivered. And then there were a number of people that were trying to call in, also had trouble with their mic or had trouble on the phone. And so even though they were in queue to speak, they ended up getting pushed out of queue so that someone else could call in, and then never ended up being able to deliver their comments. So I think, it was really tricky for a lot of people that really wanted to make sure the EPA listened to them to actually be heard.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Tiffany, were there any participants that you thought were interesting? I mean, kind of just out of nowhere appeared and started interjecting their opinions about neonicotinoids that we hadn't heard from before.
I think that there were a number of industry groups that were there, but of course it's all not surprising the industry would try to be getting EPA's ear. We had CropLife America, Bayer, a representative from the soybean industry, from the potato industry. So I think all of those groups are definitely communicating with EPA on a regular basis, and we're using this listening session to once again talk to industry and make sure that the pesticides that they're manufacturing are not going to be restricted or suspended, so that they're keeping the millions of dollars they're making every year. And then there was also a number of environmental groups. There were several farmers that spoke and several beekeepers. So I think there were a number of stakeholders there and speaking, but I think there's many more that would have liked to have speak and that need to speak in order for EPA and the administration to take action where is needed.
Thank you. It sounds like it was actually a decent mix of people that were not necessarily just industry, but other concerned parties. So
yes,
that's actually a good sign. Yeah. Tiffany, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate your time and for sharing your experience with our listeners.
Thanks, Jean, for having me on the show. And thanks, Tom.
You bet. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Now, speaking of EPA, we have some other news that's actually USDA. We just received some information that the USDA is to provide $4 million for honeybee habitat, and this just came out about 2 weeks ago, actually, and it says announcement builds on previous investment in Michigan, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how this impacts beekeepers, as well as if they can even survive next year. I mean, Tom, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it's what we called in industry a motherhood issue. How could you criticize $4 million for what they're proposing, which would be habitat improvement? But you need to look a little bit beneath the surface. $4 million spread across five states over several years really is pretty insignificant. And even were it greater, what they continue to disregard is what the level of contamination of the habitat they intend to improve may be. The evidence that we do have suggests that it's severely poisoned, and we can't improve the habitat until we have addressed that problem. So I have mixed feelings about what's been proposed. I think that it's a more posturing than anything else. I don't think it'll have a great deal of effect for the beekeepers.
Thanks, Tom. Now, there's a new article that's out, and it says, new study finds no neonic impact on bees. And this was in the Western Producer, and it says, a major Canadian study on neonicotinoids was released in late October with little pomp or circumstance. And this is, let's see, it says, bee experts Cynthia Scott Dupree of the University of Guelph and Chris Cutler of Dalhousie University concluded that canola grown from seed-coated with a neonicotinoid insecticide does not pose a risk to honey bee colonies. So, Tom, would you care to share with our audience a little bit of the history with the last study that they came out with?
Sure. The first one was the Cutler-Dupree study, and this was the life cycle study. It was the condition upon which conditional registration was granted to clothianidin, and it proved to be essentially worthless. The EPA scientists revisited it and concluded initially that it was invalid, and it was fourth grade science. It was of no real value, and in the scientific community, it was an embarrassment. Well, what we're seeing now, the one that has just been released, is the million-dollar reincarnation of that original study, and it seems to be just as bogus as the first one. And the biggest hole in this whole thing is that they have no controls. The controls have been contaminated with clothianidin. They apparently can find no safe habitat where exposure to these poisons will not be. And that's the very crux of the problem. So if there's any key finding from this study, it's that the environment has been so massively poisoned that there is no safety for the pollinators, for the honeybees. But we're going to hear from industry that this is the final word, and it, canola is safe for bees, and all of the conclusions that they would like to draw. It's not good science, and I would leave it to the scientists to critique it better than I can.
And Tom, why do they keep doing this? There's so much scientific evidence out there. You could start off with the research done by Dr. Henk Tennekes, the Dutch toxicologist who basically blew the whistle on neonicotinoids, to Dr. Menzel in Germany, to Dr. Dave Goulson in the UK. I mean, there's so many different scientists who are very well respected, who have proven the impact of neonicotinoids on so many different areas, and yet they're still trying.
Well, I think it's a very crass and unwarranted exploitation of the environment for profit. These are billion-dollar products, and I think the effort here is to keep these on the market using whatever techniques they have to until the products have outlived their useful life, and then they will trot something else out, and they will keep us at bay with those for the next 10 or 15 years, and they're already beginning to do that with the complicity of the EPA. And I would note sulfoxaflor. There's a recent one, flupyratifurone. There are all sorts of things that the EPA continues to approve, independent of the science and with unanswered questions. We're beginning to see the next generation, and the neonicotinoids may be the crisis of the past. I don't know.
Where's the protection for bees?
Well, there is none.
It seems as though there's everything out there attacking the beekeepers, that the beekeepers are doing this wrong, they're doing that wrong. I'm not a commercial migratory beekeeper, but someone who's been doing it five generations, you would think that, especially if it's a family-run business and it's something that's practically in their blood, they would be pretty careful with that business. And to see these businesses dropping left and right, and then to have different groups put the blame on the beekeeper when there's really nothing that is focusing on the actual chemical itself.
The answer to your question, June, is there is no protection. There's the illusion of protection, but there is no protection. And in fact, the EPA's efforts have been directed toward weakening what few protections there have been. I would call up the recent label changes. They're proposing that they've addressed the neonicotinoid question by suggesting that application should be made after sunset or early in the morning. And I can't see how that has any bearing whatsoever on a product that has a half-life of years. They're trying to insinuate into the regulations that it's really the responsibility of the beekeepers to stay out of harm's way. And it's called the 48-hour notice. If an applicator calls a beekeeper and said, in 48 hours, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, it now becomes the beekeeper's responsibility to do whatever is necessary to prevent that damage. And the reality is that even if the beekeeper is to move, many of those applications are still a clear violation of federal law. And the EPA is setting the scene where violation of federal law becomes a common practice.
Thank you. Now, Tom, joining us is Tibor Szabo, who's the incoming president of Ontario Beekeepers Association. Tibor, good evening, and thank you for joining us.
Good evening, June. Good evening, Tom.
Hello, Tibor.
Tibor, could you share with us the controversy that's going on in Ontario and also talk a little bit about the class action lawsuit?
Okay, I can do that. I don't know if I would call anything controversy, I guess. It's pretty recognized that the bees are being poisoned by the insecticides on the seed treatments. We have a few years of experience of that happening. There's been a lot of data collected. The bees are picking it up from the pollen of herbaceous perennials like clover and trefoil in extremely high numbers, well above the published lethal dose amounts. And so the government of Ontario has proposed restrictions on systemic, persistent, and mobile insecticides to be put into place in 2016. A lot of the research has shown that a lot of the seed treatments are not needed. They're used as kind of like an insurance. It's actually called a cheap insurance, but that's only with the cost externalized to the beekeeping community and the environment. But the fact is, a lot of these bugs that would be controlled or insects that would be controlled are not even in the fields. So the Minister of Agriculture's experts have determined about 10% to 30% of cornfields actually need some kind of insect management. And soybean fields, according to the EPA, just a few weeks ago, have absolutely no benefit from any kind of insecticide treatment on the seeds. And in Ontario, about 65% of the soybean fields have the treatment on it. So the farmers are wasting money by paying for this extra on the seeds, even though they have a choice of not buying it in most circumstances. So they're forced to pay this cost, but hopefully that will be rectified in 2016. So That's good news coming from Ontario. And the other thing you wanted me to comment on was...
the class action lawsuit.
Oh, the class action lawsuit. So there's a law firm in Canada that has started proceedings of class action against the companies of Bayer and Syngenta. They're the manufacturers of the clothianidin, imidacloprid, and thymethoxam. Those are the identified bee-killing insecticides that are used on the seed treatments. The insecticides that are found in the pollen of the that it's collected from bees at the when they're trying to come into the entrance of their hives, and also found on the dead bees during spring dust events. It's also found in the water and fields that the bees are drinking. So there's a class action lawsuit started. It's yet to be certified because in Canada there's a process for class action, and I don't know what the process is in the States, but first it has to be filed, and then it has to be certified, and then it proceeds after that, and the whole thing takes a bit of time. So it's just the beginning. Their beekeepers are signing up, and it's open to any beekeeper in Canada that is affected from these insecticides, and that's also it's a hopeful way of beekeepers getting some of their lost investment back, but it most likely will take a period of time. So it's just it's another approach. Beekeepers need to get paid back for the hives that have been poisoned over the years. It's very financially devastating for beekeepers, and so this is a process to help in that scenario. So those are both very positive. Very positive news that's coming from the province where I'm in. So,
Tibor, in regards to next year's growing season, what do you think that's going to be like? I know here in the United States, there are a lot of concerns, but we don't really hear too much from the folks up in Canada. And I think it's important, especially on this platform, that more people such as yourself, who are in a leadership position, talk about what the future holds.
Well, since the restrictions on use are not able to be put into place for next growing season, it's obviously very concerning if you are in the business of keeping insects and trying to keep them healthy. There are some steps the government is trying to do. They're trying to educate farmers to show them that they don't actually need these seed treatments in many, many cases, and that there's alternatives to using them. So that's one thing. The beekeepers themselves have been trying to not put bees in any yard where you've had very devastating poisoning. So, I mean, you're limited.
Tibor,
yes?
Let me interrupt here because we're just about out of time. You were at a meeting with Cynthia Scott Dupree, and we were talking earlier about the recent study. Can you quickly make a comment on your involvement there and what the answers were?
Well, I just went as a spectator, and I've been to one other talk of hers before, but because this study has just been published, it was kind of a relevant topic, and so I went to the dinner and listened to her talk, and it's not really a whole lot different than her last study. I mean, the pesticides were found in all colonies, not all of them, but in both control and non-control, and since all the colonies originated from the area of the biggest documented neonic poisoning event in the history of Canada, where there's about 7,000 affected hives from the spring dust off kills in 2012, these colonies that were used in the study came right from that area. In fact, within 2 kilometers of where those colonies originated, there were documented pesticide damage from neonic pesticides in the spring. So they were all already contaminated colonies, which would make the entire study, not much of a study. It was pretty much a no start right from the beginning. You need to use non-exposed colonies that have no residue of these pesticides in if you're going to do a realistic test to see what happens if they are exposed to these pesticides.
So, Tibor, we're out of time. Maybe we can get into this at some future time in a little greater detail. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this study.
Okay, Tom. I apologize. I couldn't get on the call earlier, but...
Well, we're more than happy that you did spend the time that you have participating in tonight's show. Tibor, once again, you're always welcome to call back in and share with our listeners the happenings up in Ontario and any news or events that you'd like to share with us. So, once again, thanks for calling in.
Yes, thanks, Tibor.
Okay, thank you, June. Thank you, Tom.
Tom, we are out of time. I also want to say thanks to you for participating in tonight's show. Folks, tune in each week as Tom and I discuss the latest happenings, news, and events with neonicotinoids each week. Have a great evening, everyone.